And now, The Low Post.
Welcome to The Low Post Podcast, wrapping what has been a very tough week at ESPN, and to talk all things Clippers, Jazz, playoffs, Grizzlies, obituary, whatever. Regular guest who pumped out a Is This the Clippers Last Stand feature today that is absolute must read on the eve of what literally might be their last stand. Kevin Arnovitz, how are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm hanging in. We're almost through the first round. In fact, do you know what happens on Saturday?
No basketball.
Zero NBA games. I don't know what I'm going to do. I think what I'm going to do is work a little bit during the day, spend some time with my daughter, and then when my daughter goes to sleep, the baby God's willing, I think we're going to crack open a bottle of wine and watch like some backlogged television. Like, we still haven't seen the first Silicon Valley, and there's a couple other shows that my wife and I like that were, you know, 19 episodes behind. Might just do 3 hours of that.
No, I've had the same reaction as the clock was winding down in the Memphis game. Last night, I texted my boyfriend. I was like, so do you have plans on Saturday night? And because it dawned on me, exactly same scenario. Like, do you not need to be in place for a game? In place being sort of the terminology for must be in position to at least have access to basketball viewing, if not basketball viewing itself. And I do this thing where one thing that I've noticed about these doubleheaders is I actually do this thing now where you can pause, go do something for 90 minutes during a doubleheader, come back, and still catch up at the end. So I've started kind of stealing time. But, yeah, we had the exact same reaction, which is like, I don't know, like maybe we go to dinner. This will be great. Like, dinner out of the house. It'll be fantastic.
Yeah, there's a last-minute babysitter availability search going on this morning in the Low household to see if that possibility exists. But that is not tonight. Tonight is our last sort of like mega overloaded bonanza of NBA playoff basketball. Sunday could be too, depending on how tonight goes with three games. And Clippers Jazz, I think, is the marquee matchup. And look, we've been writing around this all season. This is the biggest sort of potential fault line in the NBA, not just how it could impact the Clippers, but how it could impact the rest of the league with Chris and Blake and JJ heading into free agency and DJ only 1 year away from heading into free agency, assuming he declines an option. They're down 3-2. Blake is hurt. I've already said on my podcast yesterday, I think Utah is going to close this out tonight. You went deep on the Clippers. You're around the Clippers a lot. You produced this feature, and a lot of it is about this idea that there's a tension that has sort of always existed with the Clippers, that Chris is hard to get along with because he's constantly barking out orders and he's always right, just ask him. And he and Blake have had their ups and downs and the multiple alpha thing, and Austin Rivers yaps a lot, and Doc is a strong personality, and DJ wants more touches, but maybe he's settled on the fact that he's never going to get more touches. And you went deep into all of that and how those relationships have evolved. And I came away from the piece, and this is my I'm interested to hear what you think about this. I came away from the piece thinking the vibe, the dynamic, as you and they refer to it, the dynamic is better this year, has been better this year, but it's always like it's always one argument away from going back into a bad place, and the Clippers are good at sort of have gotten better. Blake has gotten better at stopping it from going back into the bad place. But like, it's a real, I came away from your piece thinking it's still a real thing. This is still not a team that loves each other in the way that probably they need to for optimal performance. Or have I taken the wrong takeaway?
No. I think this is, and it's a fascinating exploration that you could do at your own workplace or any person listening who's part of a company or an office. And I really tried to nail down, one of the people inside it a couple of years ago to really, stop deflecting. Like, do these people, do you all hate each other? Do you not? And what this person basically said was, let me ask you a question. And I said, okay. He's like, you work with a bunch of people at ESPN, right? And I said, yeah, of course. You like them? I'm like, almost to a person, yeah, I don't have any real strong objections. Like, I can tolerate anybody's company. He's like, and there's certain people on the team, on your team, that basically you can, you might go to dinner with, but the truth is the majority of those you probably, you wouldn't necessarily go and hang out with. outside of work. I said, that's generally true. I'm somebody in particular who enjoys sort of a division of church and state in my life. Like, I've never somebody who's had a ton of work friends. He's like, okay, now you get it. Like, what they were trying to imply was, do these guys hate each other? No, they don't hate each other. But there is a sense that, Peter Gammons once had this great characterization when he was writing for the Boston Globe about, I think it was the 78 Red Sox. And the term he used was 25 players, 25 cabs.
Did he coin that? I didn't know that was Gammons. And
I think that was from a Gammons, and we both know Boston sports fans who could probably document this. And I might be getting the entire context wrong, so this might be a complete aphorism.
For some reason, I think it was about the 70s A's teams. But we can Google that later. But anyway.
I think those guys legitimately hated each other. I think it was Gammons, and I think it was the 78 Red Sox. But, and maybe I'm drawing context away here, but the point was that I don't think anybody actively hates one another. The idea that there's Team Chris and Team Blake is overwrought. And man, I've spent a long time trying to get at it. I've had a lot of conversations. And I think it's more that they're people who are really, really different. But I think the question we're learning in the NBA is, and the Warriors and the Spurs are probably good examples of this, and you see every once in a while, you see it'll pop up, like the 2015-16 Hawks, I think, were like this, which is that, and playing with joy is really important. And I know that's not a metric. And the psychodynamics of basketball, we really haven't dug into. And Monday we'll be able to quantify joy right next to win shares and everything else. But right now we can't, and so it's kind of a cliche. And maybe it's a tautology, right? Like, oh, if you win, you're playing with joy. Or is it, if you play with joy, do you win? But I do think there's this, that whatever it is, the connective tissue that allows a team like the Warriors to just play with outright joy, or the team like the Spurs to play with a more muted joy, maybe a non-toothy smile joy, but a joy nonetheless for the process and for the game. I don't know that it exists there, and I don't think it's because anybody's a bad guy, or I don't think it's because you know, Chris is abrasive, or Blake stews in self-judgment, or DeAndre is really immature, or whatever, or Doc is just sort of Doc. I think it's just, it's like any other relationship. Like, is there a spark that is there that allows these guys to play with a level of joy that is necessary to win really big? And of course there are other factors, right? There are freak factors, and there's stuff in the piece from Daryl Morey about just the improbability of the outcome of Game 6 in 2015 when they blew that huge lead to Houston, and just the freak occurrences in 2014 when they lost that game to Oklahoma City in Game 5 of the conference semis. But do they hate each other? No, I don't know that they ever even did. Do I think they came to a – I think one of the things that's happened in the last 2 years, though, is they've come to a very – Blake Griffin describes it as, hey, okay, cool. The value of okay, cool. You know,
that was a cool part of your story where Blake is talking about how he interacts, I believe, with CP. And he talks about how maybe a couple years ago he would have, you know, and Chris is just Chris. It's how he is. He barks at people. He talks to people. He orders people around. He tells them when they screw up. He called whatever. That's just how he is. And he's he's the best point guard maybe since Magic Johnson. I mean, that's where he is in the conversation.
I totally believe that wholeheartedly.
And Blake draws this contrast between saying, okay, yeah, but let me tell my side, and just saying, okay, I'm cool, I get it. And I thought that was very interesting. Can you dive a little more deeply into that?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's this sense that so Chris Paul, because he sees the game, I think, more lucidly than anybody of his generation, other than possibly LeBron, like just in terms of seeing what is happening on the court. And JJ can talk about this, and Blake can talk about this. He'll often sort of lay down an edict, right? Like, no, this. And Blake, who sees the same game differently, right? Because he is a big man, because he's just a different person. He processes the world differently. He has a different temperament. You know, your instinct is to say, yeah, but hold on. What about X or what about Y? And what Griffin talks about is the sort of the pleasure of coming to a, all right, cool. And you might actually feel like there's another way to go, but you appreciate that in this sort of larger thing that is coming to a decision as a team on common strategy that delegating that edict to, in this case, Chris Paul, can produce real benefits. I think but what it does prompt the question, though, are you at a point now as a team where yes, dear, is essentially a stand-in for teamwork, right? Like, is okay, cool, it's an important place to get to, but is it the place to get to if you want to win big? And I don't know the answer to that question. Like, maybe the answer is yes. Maybe the answer is, hey, you know what? If two of the three worst three-point shooters in the history of the game, like, didn't hit 5 3-pointers in a quarter, that, like, we're not talking about, well, the necessity of yes, dear, or okay, cool. And, you know, I mean, we tend to have to describe retroactively the problems that exist. And yet, we don't do that if the shot was made or the shot was missed. Then we're having an entirely different conversation if the buzzer beater didn't go.
By the way, the Grizzlies. I've talked about that game ad nauseum. It's one of the flashbulb moments of the last 15 years in the NBA. I wonder how different the conversation is if they win that game and the Warriors beat them 4-1 in the conference finals. Is making the conference finals that big of a deal and that big of a check mark for a Chris Paul team that, like, all of the conversation, like, if they do that and everything since is the same, the injuries in Portland and the loss in that series, the potential loss tonight to Utah, another injury to Blake, another surgery to Blake, the Blake brawl, all of that. If they make the conference finals 2 years ago, is life really any different right now for the Clippers? If they make the conference finals and lose to a team that went on to win the championship after winning 67 games or whatever, is the conversation really that different? I don't know the answer to that. What do you think?
It's something I've grappled with because I'm with you. So in other words, let's say the bar was they got to the conference finals, right? And they bowed out at one of the most historically great teams of all time, the 2015 Warriors, right? Are we just kind of moving the goalpost then and saying, oh, they still haven't gotten to where they want to go, right? I mean, the whole premise is you break it up because they've proven they can't get there. There has been, as you say, the conference finals, which is a fairly reasonable bar for a team, not even the finals. I think, yeah, we'd probably just move the goalposts and say this is the last hurrah for the Clippers. You know, they beat Houston in a valiant game six and then bowed out to a much better Golden State team in 2015. But the bottom line is they're not good enough to get over the Warriors and now sit in that sort of second tier. It's time to break it up and they're going to have to pay this enormous tax. Right. Yeah, I'm with you. Like, I don't know. I think the importance of that game is not that it created this ceiling, but it has informed their psyche ever since. Like, I think there was disappointment after the Oklahoma City loss and, you know, particularly in Chris Paul just because it was such an improbable series of errors and it was a tough one.
Isn't it amazing how, like, it's just amazing how it was an improbable series of errors. I mean, they had a 7-point lead. I think they had a 9-point lead with like a minute left in that game and somehow lost. It's amazing how crazy stuff happens. Like, I was watching the Raptors-Bucks game last night. And my wife was on the couch with me because her and my daughter are going to be in Toronto, totally sort of unrelated. They tend to take playoff trips when I start to travel for the playoffs, and my wife's parents live in Toronto. And so she was kind of rooting for the Raptors because if they win, I'm going to go to Cleveland, and then I'm going to go to Toronto. And we'll at least, you know, I can do a little daddy time while if we're both in the same city. And the Raptors are up, you know, whatever. They're up a million points, and we're starting to make plans. And then there's, you know, there's still and I'm telling her, just, this is the Raptors. This is what they do. Don't, like, we're not making plans yet. And then, like, just the and then they take back the lead. And then they almost give it up again with this comedy of errors of DeRozan going to the rim where all he has to do is dribble out the clock. And yeah, he got fouled, but just dribble out the clock. And then, what the hell else happened? I don't know. They fouled the 3-point shooter. They almost couldn't inbound the ball. It never ever, and then Giannis dunks with 3 seconds left instead of taking a three. Anyway, you just never know. But yeah, that meltdown in 2014, that was the Sterling year when everything was sort of everything is forgiven. And the 15 team was better, I think, which is why that Houston meltdown, it just stands out so strongly.
Yeah, it's funny, and there is actually a debate within the Clippers, was our better chance in 2014 or 15? I mean, both years they'd be up against just a really competent opponent in either the Spurs or the Warriors, and the 14 Spurs, I forget how good they were. But, yeah, I mean, it's interesting whether, you know, how that informs. I think it's more about the psyche, though. I think it did reinstitute this idea of a supernatural force, this ineffable thing that prevents this team from winning. It doesn't matter who the owner is. It doesn't matter that you have the most competent point guard of his generation running point, or that all the pieces fit, or they don't fit, or that Doc Rivers is a championship coach, or, hey, it's this really great market, that ultimately something will befall this team of just incredible consequence, whether it is an injury, two injuries in the same playoff game, or you know, Josh Smith becomes Reggie Miller for 25 minutes, and there's nothing you can do about it. You actually wanted to give him those shots. And I think that loss, though, against Houston does inform the psyche, and it's just this shadow that looms, and they'll cop to it, actually.
Oh, no, they've been very open about, you know, what happened to them in that game, the impact of it going forward. And I just think, you know, the vibe, the dynamic is just so fascinating. When I talked, I wrote about them in December when they came here, and I talked to both Chris and Blake. And they told me that this was about after. In fact, your story sort of picks up the narrative from mine in some ways, because they had gone 14-2, and then they went in a slump when they lost to the Nets, they lost to the Pacers, and they were kind of down in the dumps. And I talked to Chris and Blake about the flight from Indiana to New York, and they were in a slump. And Chris came over to talk to Blake, I think, on the plane, and they were talking about the game. And both of them, almost unprompted, mentioned to me, like, the conversation was actually really good. It was productive. We talked about the game. We said we're going to be fine. We just need to do X, Y, and Z. And in the past, there would have been, like, I think I quoted Chris saying, in the past, we would have pointed fingers at each other and said, you know, this guy needs to do this, and there would have been tension, and it's better this year. It's better this year is a thing that you kept hearing, but it's still not great. And I took the same thing from your piece. It's better this year, but is still where we are.
Yeah, I mean, I think these teams are like marriages. Right. And I think it is better this year. I mean, the question is do you have to clear a certain level or a certain threshold to make it great? Is this kind of not a loveless marriage, but one of those marriages where, hey, you know, we've learned to accept certain deficiencies and shortcomings of each other. And, you know, and we can live together. Now, is that a loving marriage? I don't know. I know many people who are in long-term relationships that are functional, and you're pretty good, and it's a relatively productive partnership. But is it just a love affair? I don't know. You know, and what level do you need to cross in order to win an NBA championship or get the conference finals, whatever bar you set? I don't know. And I think that's sort of the thing, is that we kind of make it a binary thing. Either this team gets together, it doesn't together, it loves it, they love each other, they hate each other. And I think more generally, it's like any other relationship. There are really good months and years, and there are years where you regress. And with this team, I think it's just, you know, that's it. I don't think there's like this team Blake versus team Chris finance. No, it's not. First of all, like, I don't even think there are like alliances and coalitions where, you know, some locker rooms, you know, and you start digging in and it's like, oh, there's that click and that click. And maybe it's along generational lines, or it's on some other lines or cultural lines, or here are the religious guys in the locker room, and here are the guys who kind of aren't part of Team God or whatever. And I've heard all sorts of characterizations like that about all sorts of teams. It's just, they're just different dudes, and they all have kind of really different lives. You know, I mean, and Chris Paul is this really busy guy who is a really devoted dad and has all these extracurriculars and charities and AAU teams and plans his like high school reunions, and is somebody in life who enjoys like being busy. Blake Griffin's a real introvert. Comes as a surprise, and it's kind of counterintuitive because, you know, you see him on commercials and he's got this deadpan humor. But he's kind of a listener observer type in any sort of huddle situation or any conflict. Like, he's somebody who, you know, for whom communication is sort of this, you know, last resort, but actually life can sort of be managed and navigated, you know, without a lot of like talking about and taking stock of the relationship, right? Which is not the way, you know, Doc or Chris, or for that matter, DeAndre Jordan might function. It's just different. Nobody's right or wrong. And I think this sort of assigning, you know, blame to one party or the other. And yeah, everybody has their worst flaw, right? And you know, DeAndre Jordan is kind of immature. It came out immaturity actually hijacked the league for 2 days in the Dallas situation that summer, right? And Blake can kind of seethe in self-judgment. I think talk himself into bad games was something that Doc said, as with affection and with, you know, with care. He wouldn't mean it as a total criticism. It was like, hey, that's the next step, is when people are really self-critical, you know, that can manifest itself. And, you know, that might be his, say, fatal flaw, if there is such a thing. But just as a cocktail, it's just they're different guys. And it's a fascinating study. And, you know, that great question, which is, do you need to play joyfully in order to win, or do we look at a winning team and say, of course they play joyfully, and, you know, and ascribe it retroactively, which, you know, it doesn't really do anything, right? Because if the answer is, no, you don't actually play joyfully until you win, then what are we even measuring here?
I can't think of anything, many worse tests than planning my high school reunion. Why does Chris Paul do that?
I don't know. I think it was a Lee Jenkins captured in a story a couple of years ago.
I don't remember.
I love planning. I don't like hurting kittens.
Oh,
That's sort of my thing. Like, I could plan some friends' trips abroad and would have a great time doing it.
My high school class was like 550 people or something. Like, we just had our 20-year reunion. That's how freaking old I am. And I went, and it was wonderful. I had a great time. And that's my role at the high school. I'll show up. Just tell me where and when. I'll show up. My parents still live in my hometown. I'll go. But my God, the level of organization, and there were like multiple events, and you had to get people to pay you. Imagine getting 550 high school classmates to try to pay you the money. And then we got notes afterward being like, hey, we actually overspent the budget. We need more money from all of you. And like, I've happily paid it, but I can't imagine I'm sure that the organizers ended up eating. It just seems like, do you go to your high school reunions?
I have never been to a Riverwood High School reunion.
Wow.
Not one. I was a little weird. Like, I was wearing platform shoes and tuxedo shirts and, like, had this big, enormous Jufro. Like, I was just a little odd. And it was never – I don't remember – like, I think I was about to say, like, I don't remember actively disliking high school, but now, actually, I revise that. I remember really actively disliking high school.
I didn't go to any of ours until 10 years, I think, and I went to the 10-year one reluctantly. And I had a great time.
You know who I was? I was in Dazed and Confused. I was Adam Goldberg. I didn't get my ass kicked like at the kegger. Like, I didn't, you know, for running my mouth. But I was essentially that guy sitting there talking about like what was going to happen in the Ford Carter election, like in the backseat of the car, trying to get to the party and like,
yeah, but there's
sort of being neurotic about it.
There's a cute girl in that car. The redheads in that car.
Marissa Ribisi, right?
Yeah, and
they're
up
with Wooderson.
And they're headed to the party. They're at the cool party. Yeah, that's a perfectly fine. That's a perfectly fine doppelganger or whatever.
All right, just very quickly. I watched it recently, and because I hadn't seen it in a couple of years, and there was a time in my life where I was watching it regularly. It's one of my favorite movies, and largely because I think it just captures high school between the coasts. Like, I think most of you and I grew up with sort of the John Hughes, you know, wealthy North Shore suburb of Chicago high school movie, where it's very Manichean, good kids and bad kids and poor kids and rich kids. And what's so brilliant about Dazed and Confused is how just it kind of really captures, like, high school life at a certain moment in time. And obviously we're much younger than that group, but, like, when you live not in a northeastern suburb or a West Coast or the North Shore of Chicago, but just kind of suburban South. And that's kind of what I love about that movie. And that's, you know, no real heroes or villains other than, like, the Ben Affleck character or the 10th grader. But it's just – it's a wonderful kind of naturalistic view of high school that just – it's one of my favorite movies. But I was Adam Goldberg in that movie. That was me. That was essentially my function.
I love Dazed and Confused. I will watch it for 10 minutes anytime I come across it on TV. Everyone is brilliant in it. I got sucked into an IMDb hole about 3 months ago where I was like, all right, I want to know whatever happened to that guy and whatever happened to that guy and whatever happened to that guy.
It's so funny. We did this. This was a few weekends ago. We actually were looking at, like, who is this? Like, who is the guy who plays the old guy who sells him beer at the stand? And it turns out, hey, he's this local actor, this repertory actor in Austin, Texas. Of course it is. Of course, that's who Linkletter uses to be the guy who is the perfect 7-Eleven weekend shift guy who'll sell the underage kids beer actor. And yeah, so we did this too, like in all these like local Austin, Texas actors. It's a great movie.
A lot of the bit guys are like those sort of tertiary characters in the movie. They've not really gone on to do much else since Dazed and Confused. Like, they did a couple of things and then they fell away. Didn't Linklater just make like an 80s version of that?
Yes.
What's it called? Is it good?
Everybody Wants Some, I think, is the name of the movie.
I got to see it. It's good.
I saw it on a plane. It's absolutely worth seeing. Also kind of takes that very non-judgmentally look at sort of the mating habits of kids at a certain moment in time. And This is what I love about it. Like, I just like that he doesn't feel the need to create heroes and villains. It's kind of what I loved about Freaks and Geeks.
I never got into Freaks and Geeks.
Yeah, I mean, it's very much in that spirit, which is like high school isn't really a morality play. It's more surrealist than that. like growing up is just there aren't these morality plays. There are very few successes and failures. It's just you're just kind of groping for like 18 years and just get me out of here. Everyone wants some. I think I got the name right. I'm senile, by the way. So as we talked about last episode. So yeah.
Maybe that'll be a Saturday. Maybe that'll be the Saturday night entertainment. Maybe we'll scrap the TV shows and watch the 80s, whatever it is, the 80s version of Dazed and Confused. Okay, we've gotten off track, but a Richard Linklater thing is not a bad way to get off track. We'll be right back with more from ESPN's Kevin Arnovitz. If they lose tonight, everyone's already written their break up the Clippers column four times over by now. There will be a renewed push for that. And that is actually quite a complicated question because it's not as easy as just saying they didn't make it. It's time for something new. That's not how NBA teams think. What NBA teams think is if not this, then what? And the if not this, then what to me is unclear. A, because the Clippers don't control all the cards here. Chris Paul is a free agent. They can offer him more money than anyone else, but he is a free agent. Blake is a free agent, and their home court advantage with him is not as large as it is even with Chris. JJ Redick is a free agent. They can do whatever the hell they want. And if they want to leave, the Clippers can try to entice both of them to be signed and traded to wherever they are. That's complicated, but doable for each of them. And that's it. I mean, and so if that scenario leaves you with DeAndre Jordan and question mark, and given that they've drafted nobody of any use in the last X amount of years and traded away picks for not good players, that's a bottom out scenario. And do you want to bottom out if you're the Clippers, where you've spent 90% of your existence bottoming out through self-inflicted wounds? And so they don't even control the process. And not only that, the flip side is if you bring them all back, you're looking at almost $200 million in salary plus luxury tax for a team that loses in the first round of the playoffs. And Steve Ballmer told you, this is what all the owners say, I'm happy to pay the luxury tax for a team that can contend for a championship. Can this team contend for a championship? Can this team as is contend for a championship? And then let's zero in on Blake. Because to me, Blake has become a fascinating free agent. I was talking to an executive from another team the other day about Blake, and he's just injured all the time. And he is, what is Blake, 27? 28?
Yeah.
Something in that range,
I think.
So he's past his athletic prime.
Oh, he's 28. I'm sorry, he just turned 28.
He's past his athletic prime. And yet, he has these stretches where, and my declaration to this guy, which is not controversial, is I just think Blake Griffin top 10 player is over. I just don't think we'll ever see that player again. Maybe top 20, but not top 10. And then you look like at the beginning of the season, he was a monster, and then he got hurt. Then he came back in February, and he was a monster again like 25, 30, 28. Look at the game logs. And then he's injured again. In this series, he just hasn't looked as mobile and powerful as he did even when he was a monster in earlier parts of the season. And I'm just not – I would be very – and you know the teams that will pursue him. Boston will look at him even though the Horford fit is a little tricky. Miami would look at him. The Lakers will look at him. We can go on and on. I'm missing an obvious – no, I don't think I'm missing an obvious suitor. He'll get a max deal, I think, and at his peak, he's worth it. But he's been a long time fascinating player because he's the power forward who can't protect the rim and can't shoot threes, and that may be changing the last part of that in a very interesting way. And now he's an interesting piece because no one quite knows what to make of him, because you get this short burst of like, oh, that's the guy who was third in MVP voting 3 years ago. And then that guy goes away for a while, and then he comes back and he's back, and then he's not the same. And no one quite knows what to make of him. So take any of that, the if not this, then what, or Blake or whatever. Like, this is not just – blow it up. Blow it up is not easy.
Right, and this is one of the things when I'm asked, do you blow it up, I reject the premise, like you do, because you act as if there's like this one person controlling the switch, as if there is a button to detonate, because no, there's not. There's several different buttons, and there are different hands on each button, and Blake Griffin gets to decide whether or not, I mean, whether to blow it up is assuming that Blake Griffin wants to return or Chris Paul wants to return, as you say. You know, Griffin's an interesting case because we've talked about this ad nauseum when we kind of debate the max salary and should it exist and should it not exist, is the truth is that you can justify the max for a lot of players because it is such an artificial ceiling. And the truth is Blake is probably worth the max in the same way that Mike Conley is probably worth the max, in the sense that the max probably doesn't even account for a third of, let's say,
and by the way,
Steph Curry's value or LeBron James's value.
And by the way, look what's happened in this series. If you're going to bring Chris Paul at age 31 or 32 back at the max for the full 5 years, just in this series alone, Doc Rivers is bemoaning the lack of secondary ball handling and playmaking to take pressure off Chris Paul. I mean, all fit issues aside, that's what Blake Griffin is. So if your solution is, well, Blake, we can let Blake go because of injury risks and bring Chris back, and we've played very well without Blake. Every year when he gets injured, we win 2/3 of our games or something close to it without Blake, and we put shooters around Chris and DJ and blah, blah, blah. Okay, sounds good, but like you need something. You need something else. You need someone else to do some stuff on offense other than set picks for Chris Paul and shoot threes.
There's a certain tragedy to it, which is if they lose tonight, it might be because they're playing a team that has four large wings, three of whom are exceptional in pick and roll situations running offense. We're not even talking about George Hill, right? And Hood's getting there, right? Like I don't think he's a preternatural, playmaker, but he's there, and basically a bunch of really big wings who can shoot and play out of the pick and roll. And the Clippers with Austin Rivers not even being healthy, and he didn't look well. That's it. Like you're talking about. I mean, JJ did a really nice job putting the ball on the floor, but that's not what you bring him in to do. I mean, that's not his function in an offense. It's not. You're not going to put the ball in the hands of JJ Redick to work out of the pick and roll. It's the last thing you do with him. So it's ironic that they might very well go out on against a team that beats them on a Friday night doing that. I don't know. I mean, here's the question about blow it up. I think Chris and Blake are worth the max because, again, it's an artificial ceiling, and they will put up that production. With Blake, discerning the injury thing is difficult because it's not like there's this recurring thing, right? The toe injury was freaky. He hit a guy, and like that is not a natural cause, right?
How many knee surgeries are we into this now for Blake, though?
But there I think there was only one on each. Am I correct? Like, I'm getting my knees mixed up, but it's not this one festering problem. Now, I don't know enough about biomechanics to say, hey, there's just something about this particular frame and this guy with this particular mass. So I'm also reluctant to say that this is not a guy with a recurring foot problem. This is not, Odin. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
Like, it's different things, and half of them are freaky, and it's almost just in a league with 450 guys playing this way, invariably they're going to always be a handful of them who just, by the sheer bad luck of the dealer, just draw terrible cards, and it has nothing to do with their playing strategy or their natural inclination as a player. It's just who they are. It's not who they are. It's just consequence. I don't know if Blake's in that category. So I'm just always like, I'm going to say, oh, he's always getting injured because he had this weird toe thing. Like, you know what I'm saying? Like, I'm even nervous saying that, oh, he's a guy who's always going to be injured going forward. Also, considering that Tim Duncan was a guy who had trouble staying healthy and then basically was pretty much had a clean bill of health for, the second half of his career. So and yet I also look at a guy whose dunk rate is falling. And so often that is used as a measure of athleticism and going forward, just, will he be able to give you that same component of his game? Yet, as you say, he's been like a 38-39% 3-point shooter for quite a while until he went down.
That's interesting. Okay. Since February 1st, Blake Griffin is shooting 38.5% on three plus triples a game. That's not one a game. That's not like, oh, okay, I guess I got to take this one. No one's within 20 feet of me. That's three a game. It's not a ton, but it's not a little. And 38.5% is good. Now, they are wide open looks because teams are going to give him pick and pop threes, or when he's spotting up somehow around a DJ pick and roll, they're just going to give him that. But, you know, like, teams are still giving Marc Gasol a lot of pick and pop threes. Like, big guys just get threes, and a lot of them are open. And if he starts to make, and it is this sort of like, do you really want Blake Griffin shooting seven threes a game when he's a good post player, a good passer, a good rebounder? But, you know, Marc Gasol has shown that there's a happy place for big men where you don't trade out that much of what you do on the inside to do a little bit more on the outside that makes your team better.
Yeah, I'm very curious to see what Blake does. And the one observation that was given to me, and I kind of, as I floated it to others, they really like this, was, you know, are Chris and Blake going to come back? Which I think is going to be the new question to, do they blow it up? People are going to realize, as you said, like, it's not their choice. It's ultimately about the decision these guys make. And, you know, one person said, he's like, here's what's going to happen. Chris is going to take a million meetings, right? Like, it's going to be a public process. He's going to be the bell at the ball. You know, there'll be some place set up, and that's where he'll do it. And we'll have the usual procession of meeting times and executives shuffling through with their presentations and whatever. And he'll ultimately stay with the Clippers. And the CBA has been written somewhat under his direction, you know, to maximize his profits for staying. And good for him, right? And that Blake will do a very quiet process. It'll be under the guise of a night. He doesn't want to do this full recruitment and dog and pony show. But if you're asking which guy is more likely to leave, you know, it might very well be Griffin. He's never seen unrestricted free agency, and I have to wonder to what extent he wants to see what else is out there. I mean, the dynamic is the only thing he knows. And whether it is the process of whether it is anybody's fault, or whether it is, oh, we're just very different people, I often wonder, you know, if he wonders, you know, is there a different sort of cultural channel, or is there just a different way to do this? And what would it be like under a different set of leadership? And not because he's happy or unhappy, but just out of sheer curiosity. And I think this notion of Blake, oh, he loves L.A., he's a comedy guy, you know, all the commercials, is baloney. I mean, his producing partner lives in Charlotte, North Carolina, where he's the linebacker for with the Panthers. And, you know, I think he's somebody who understands that you can, as free agents have been telling us every single summer, hey, guys, guess what? We can live in L.A. in the off season. This idea that you got to go to this market, I think more than ever now, it's like, look, for the 8 months you're in, you know, you're working, you're on a plane half the time, you're on the road. It's not, you can take the time during the off season. The idea that you need to play in a glitz market. And I still think there are guys who always want to play in the glitzy market, but I don't think Griffin's that guy. Like, I think Griffin could be completely happy in a mid-market city doing what he does and, you know, having his stuff in the off season. Like, I don't think he's a guy who needs this idea that, oh, he's going to stay because he loves LA, or he's going to go to the Lakers because, hey, he just has to move his belongings 50 feet down the hall, and now he gets to rid himself of the Clipper curse and get to stay in his home and all that. Like, I don't know. I think he'll look at the Lakers like he would look at any other team, which is, can I win here? Is there a culture that's drama-free? And, I mean, he might look at the Lakers and say, well, what would I want to be here for right now? And, oh, well, if they bring Paul George, well, the truth is Paul George is a four. Like, I mean, I hate to say it, but he is. And
see, I don't agree with that. I don't agree with the rush to make Paul George a four. It's an interesting conversation. I get what Indiana was trying to do. Even when he played four there, they had C.J. Miles do the Shane Battier, I'm going to guard the four so you don't have to. So maybe it's just sort of a facile distinction anyway.
I guess here's what I'm saying. Do you want him to play with two bigs or one big?
If one of the bigs is Miles Turner and Miles Turner shoots four threes a game next year?
What if the big is Blake Griffin?
Well, then this is why Blake.
That's my point. I don't love them at the forward spots together. That's what I'm saying.
My thing with Paul George is,
you believe Blake is a five, which I don't.
Do you want? Well, he could be a backup five, I think, which is something that the Clippers have never explored well enough in terms of how they stagger minutes and how he could be a backup five. But that's a different conversation. My question with Paul George is: Do you want him defending Jimmy Butler, or do you want him defending Nikola Mirotic? Do you want him defending LeBron James, or do you want him defending? Well, Kevin Love is really good, so that's not a bad, that's not a good example. I don't look at Paul George and say that's. It's not Joe Johnson. It's not a guy who's like, okay, he's aged into – I don't know. I don't get the rush to make Paul George a four, but that's a different question. Regarding Blake, I will say this. It's not like I'm talking to these guys every day about what they're going to do, nor are you, nor is anybody except their inner circle. I don't think any of them are 100% sure they're coming back. Let's say that. I don't think any of them are no-brainers. I think all of them will look, and I think lots of different stuff that we don't even know about is going to be in play when we hit to July 1st, if they lose this game or if they lose in the next round in demoralizing fashion. And we all know who's waiting in the next round. Blake is so interesting, as you mentioned, his diverse interests, his personality lending itself to different places, the L.A. thing not being as big a deal as people think. Whenever a big free agent hits the market off a winning team, that's like Kevin Durant. That becomes a really interesting situation because they're going to take pitches from some teams that are not as good, that are not 55-win teams. And what, like Denver and Phoenix are going to try and get into every possible room. And you just mentioned the Lakers, who are three or four players away from being any good. How much do you care about winning is right away anyway is a fascinating, you know, if you want a different culture, are you willing to win 40 games in year one to get a different culture? That's a fascinating question to me.
Yeah, I think for him, and I know every player says this, but I really think for him, it's winning in an environment that's just copacetic. You know, like I think I agree with you, the Boston's a weird fit because of Horford, but I think like that would be an interesting template for him. A system coach who's just kind of chill, you know, with the trains run on time in an organization where there's not a lot of palace intrigue in Boston right now. There just isn't. I mean, they've got it's sort of solid a structure of leadership there as you can have. You know, there's not a lot of internecine warfare. I mean, yeah, people disagree on stuff, but you know, that I think would be appealing to him. I'm not suggesting that's where he's going or he's even going to consider going, but I'm saying if you wanted to draw a place that might kind of create a scenario which might draw his interest, I think that's an example.
Well, they've had trade talks before, never really got serious, but I don't think weird is bad necessarily. I mean, we've seen in the playoffs, Al Horford, when the going gets tough, is going to be a five. I mean, that's just they may start Amir Johnson again in the next round if they advance past Chicago. But Al Horford's going to play a lot of center, and when the chips are down, Al Horford is going to be a center. And Blake Griffin, and he can shoot threes, and the collective passing between and playmaking between the two of them is so strong, two of the best passing we've been in the league, that I think that fit could actually work.
I'm all for upsizing, as you know. I mean, I think most fours in this league are five, and most threes in the leagues are four. I love doing that. I just at some point, you know, you leave. It's just to leave yourself so vulnerable. Like the fact that you can do everything right in terms of offensive execution and still lose a basketball game because you cough up, you know, 35% of your defensive rebounds on a given night is just it's treacherous. It's a really treacherous way to win championships in the NBA. It's just knowing you can actually execute beautifully, but guess what? 37% of your misses, you know, or their misses went back to them. I mean, and that's just, it's a tough way to win a championship. It just feels like when you stand at the craps table that long in a seven-game series, like it's going to happen. And it just scares me for them. Unless you can get, they need to get positional rebounders, you know, the two and the three who are just really, really, they can just narrow the difference. But, you know, I mean, Atlanta figured that out the hard way. And I'm a huge Horford fan. And was sort of heartbroken he left Atlanta. But it just is Blake could be an elite rebounder again, though I don't know. I mean, scheme can affect some of it, but it just it worries me for Boston a little bit. And you can get over it, but it does worry me.
Let's quickly talk about the Grizzlies, because the Clippers haven't lost yet, and maybe they'll win on the road and go on to take the series, and we'll see what happens. The Grizzlies lost to the Spurs last night in a series that turned out to be pretty competitive, And again, everyone is going to sort of write the obituary to grit and grind where Tony Allen's a free agent, Zach Randolph's a free agent, DeMichael Green is a free agent, and Vince Carter is a free agent. Mike, if you could really look at this, I mean, the Grizzlies' future, everyone has talked about, they're capped out, they've traded picks, the Parsons thing is what it is. If you want to be encouraged, you can say Marc Gasol is still at peak form, Mike Conley gets better every year. Those two guys are really, really good, and we were competitive with the Spurs. If you plopped a healthy Chandler Parsons, if such a thing could ever exist, into this team with Pete Gasol and Pete Conley, that's a pretty good team. Like, Ennis is a player. Harrison has totally proven me wrong, looked good in this series. Some of the young guys will play more, presumably. Like that's a pretty solid. That's a positive way to look at it. The negative way to look at it is that Chandler Parsons' health is a giant question mark and may never be resolved. And all those free agents exist, and you don't have cap room, functional cap room, if all four of them leave, and like in a nightmare scenario or whatever, you have $8-9 million of cap room. You can't do much with that. Cap room is just not going to be a part of their offseason. What do you do if you're the Grizzlies with those outgoing players?
It's so difficult. I don't break it up, and here's why. I mean, first of all, this idea that, you know, because you have a minuscule chance to win with this particular composition of players, true. Without them, I think you have a zero. And I keep going back to the Utah Jazz of the 90s. And they were sort of a very much a Memphian team for a very long time. You know, it was Stockton and Malone. And there became a point where they realized, you know, they weren't going to do it with Thurl Bailey, Mark Eaton, and some combination of Blue Edwards and Jeff Malone, and Ty Corbin was on that team, and I forget who else. I think actually was Mike Brown on that. I know, not David Benoit, whoever it was. And I love that team. And, you know, I think it would have been calls to break it up, and then they were kind of middling around, losing first round series. Break it up. But actually, it turns out that in their latter days together, Stockton and Malone, I mean, this is long after their peak. I mean, people forget when they got to the finals in the famous, Jordan shot against Brian Russell. Like, Stockton and Malone were past their peak, well past their peak. But what had happened is the Jazz had sort of figured out the alchemy, right? They brought in Hornacek. They brought in Russell. The much maligned Greg Ostertag, you know, with some minutes for Antoine Carr. Like, it was actually when those guys were after their prime, but the complementary pieces just made more sense, that they were essentially one push off away from a title. And I just feel like for the Grizzlies, given who they are in their market, given what the market is, I still think, and also just given what Conley's done this season, like, I don't think that guy's fallen off anytime. I don't want to say soon, but I think you got this guy for a few more years in a great situation. And Gasol reinventing himself. Like, I just keep trying to shuffle the deck. Just keep at it.
Well, that's the thing. You don't really have a choice. Like, everyone, oh, blow up the grit and grind. Well, okay, so the two best players are really good, and they're under contract for a really long time. So blow up grit and grind means you are trading them, at least one of them. Like, and if not, if one, then why not both? Like, that's what blow it up is. Because if they're on your team, you're going to be a solid, you know, somewhere between 5th and 10th. You're going to be in playoff contention every year. And if the upside might be higher than that. The issue is that if you bring back all four of those guys, Randolph, Vince, Tony Allen, and Jamichael Green, you're going to be over the tax. And I don't think they want to be over the tax for this group of players. They're also going to have 15 players under contract for next year, assuming they pick up Seldon's option, which is perhaps not a good assumption. I don't think they can bring all four of those guys back. What's your take on that?
I think there's an individual case for each one. I just think you have to. I think it's Conley, Gasol, and you have to shuffle the deck. And not because there's anything fatally wrong with any of those guys, but this is the NBA. You know what's going to happen? They're going to find their Draymond Green in the second round, or they're going to find their Jonathan Simmons, Patty Mills, Danny Green off the scrap heap after being released from a terrible Cleveland team. Like, they're going to find their Joe Ingles or Rodney Hood or whatever. Like, the way this happens is not you don't go out and get the third guy. I don't even think it's Chandler Parsons. Like, the story of the NBA is the story of a couple of really awesome guys with, holy cow, where did that guy come from? I mean, that is the NBA. And so unless you have your – you're not winning it without a second round – guy making good, or a late first round guy getting good. You're not making it unless you reclaim some sort of D-League castaway and turn him into a really functional player, a rotation guy, and maybe even a starter on a championship team. And so everybody who wants to kind of look at the spreadsheet and look at the free agent top 25 list, and let's spend all our money signing the best guy out there that we can get, it's got it wrong. It's, where is your mid-first rounder who turns into a superstar? Where is your second rounder who turns into, who basically for 4 years gives you $12 to $15 million in production for a fraction of the price? And that is the NBA. And so the best hope for Memphis is to keep Conley, Gasol, and have just figure out, not figure it out, because it's a crapshoot, I mean, the probabilities are low, but you just have to find those people and hope that you have the player development staff and the culture and guys like Conley and Console who can encourage that development, and you just have to be really good talent scouts. And I'm just starting to believe that that's really the thing, is we can talk trade machine and all that other stuff, and who do they get for – no, you know what you do? You go out and get those guys. Those are who the championship teams enlist ultimately. It's not that they go make some big-ass, splashy free agent signing. It's they develop that person.
Well, it's ironic that we're having this conversation at the end of a podcast that was largely about the Clippers, because that's what the that's what the Clippers never did, and that's
the Clippers. Here's the, I mean, honestly, if you want the sad truth about the Clippers, it's not that Chris Paul is bossy or Blake Griffin is cursed or whatever, or DeAndre Jordan is whatever it is. It's where can you, other than Luke Bamute, who's been a wonderful reclamation project, like where have they succeeded? They're going to go up against Joe Ingles tonight. Like, who have killed them in two of these games. A guy that they let go. And look, I don't think anybody at the time, we were all like, oh, they're crazy. I'm not going to act as if I was clairvoyant at the time, and I killed them for that release because they felt like they needed a more pure point guard as the 15th guy on the roster. But at the end of the day, the failure of the Clippers, in some respects, is show me one player they maxed out potential on whose ultimate result showed great variance from their projected result. And the answer is, there's, other than Bamute fitting in lovely in that unit, there's just none. They pissed away draft picks. They signed a bunch of 2008 Eastern Conference retread all-stars, thinking you could just, like, patch it together with a bunch of vets. You know, you devalue your late first-round picks because, oh, we're picking 25th, who cares? Well, just because you don't value the pick doesn't mean the rest of the league doesn't value the pick. Why not evaluate your assets based on how they're perceived in the market, not how you perceive them, just because you don't really enjoy the work of trying to develop a schleppy guy with real flaws into a real NBA player. And that's the sad truth about all this. It's not Chris's fault, it's not Blake's fault, it's not DeAndre's fault, is where is that guy? They don't have them. They've just tried to they've unfortunately, I think, been lazy as an organization in terms of all that. And I think it's the margin. That's the margin. That's the difference between these other teams and them, is they've done nothing to max out the margins.
I like when you get a little fired up about this.
Yeah, it felt good.
The Grizzlies, I mean, we can talk about Vince and all this. A lot of it comes down to, do you want to bring back the cornerstones of grit and grind? Zebo and his bruising interior game that everyone loves, and Tony Allen, who coined the phrase, and his defense was sorely missed in this series when Kawhi Leonard went nuclear on everybody. Those are really hard choices because, I you bring them all back, and I factored in conservative salaries, I think. You're going to go into the tax. I think, to me, it's hard, as painful as it is for your culture and your fans, I think you got to prioritize JaMychal Green over Zach Randolph. And
I agree.
And if it comes down to it, if Zach Randolph has to be on another team next year, so be it. And Vince and Tony Allen, I mean, I don't know how, it might be time to move on from Tony Allen at age 35 with all these injuries, but they just have no real means to replace him other than the mid-level exception. And maybe they could get an okay wing somewhere with the mid-level exception. But I, if it comes down to Zach or JaMychal, I just think JaMychal Green shot 38% from three. He can switch across multiple positions. He's a more modern NBA player. I think it might be time.
Yeah, we did one of those little five-on-fives, and I wrote, the question was, is do you prioritize Randolph or Green? And I said Green. I mean, there was one play last night that was sort of heartbreaking. It was about 2 minutes left. I think they were down two at the time. And it was a Conley, it was a step-up screen, Gasol for Mike Conley. The Spurs trap it. Conley pivots beautifully and just kind of throws this pass to sort of the pressure release pass to Gasol, who slips to the foul line. And so here it is, right? You got a playmaking center who's 7 feet tall. He has demanded a rotator, which comes up from the baseline from Zach. And I forget who the defender was. It was David Lee. And so now you're screwed, right? You're the Spurs, you're screwed. You've got Gasol can either probably rise up and shoot if he wants. He can do a high-low to Randolph, and he's got James Ennis in the corner, and Patty Mills is stunting off him. So now Ennis is wide freaking open in the right corner. This is the modern, this is the quintessential modern NBA offensive play that you want, right? Your pick-and-roll attack yields to these spread shooters or a guy ducking in. all these options, not all of them can be accounted for by the defense. He gets it to Ennis, wide open in the corner. And he hesitates. He doesn't shoot the ball. And now, of course, the defense closes, and he's wide freaking open. And then he tries to back Mills in. It's a disaster. And in fact, I think the camera's caught, if I'm correct, Dave Fizdale saying, why didn't you shoot the ball? And the answer is because he couldn't. And the answer is that is, to me, this was the great – if there was one scene that captured the tragedy of the Memphis Grizzlies, Conley, Gasol, pick and roll, run to perfection, ball delivered to a great playmaking big man who now has multiple options. He goes to the wing where most NBA offenses would go, because why do a two for Zach rather than a three in the corner? And he's got James Ennis, who's done wonderful work as a defender in this series, and I really love what Fiz is doing with him. I'm not trying to kill James Ennis because I really respect James Ennis. But at the end of the day, they couldn't shoot. He wouldn't shoot. And that, therein lies Memphis Grizzlies basketball on its worst day. And I love Memphis Grizzlies basketball, as you well know. But that, to me, is like that one play at the moment of their mortality on the season. That one play captured it all.
I believe he drove and tried to find Zebo, and and Kawhi stole it because Kawhi steals everything. Yeah, they had all those plays where Marc Gasol would, there was a little screen to screen reaction, and he'd slip down the left sideline, and the third rotator would rotate off David Lee, or someone would rotate off Zach Randolph and be in Marc Gasol's face. And you say, well, how can they rotate to Marc Gasol that fast and risk leaving the other side of the floor so naked? And it's because the guy guarding James Ennis is already guarding Zach Randolph before any of that starts. They've already started. You feel the lack of shooting not in the first rotation. It's like the rotation behind the rotation behind the rotation, and it just screws everything up. So anyway, that's the Grizzlies. They're done. You've got to go. I've got to go. It's maybe the last day of the first round tonight. Hopefully not. Hopefully we get some.
But the first day of the rest of our lives, Zach.
Yeah, that's true. All right, I will see you down the road at some point, Kevin Arnovitz. Keep up the good work. Everyone, read his long and awesome feature on the Clippers, which is leading ESPN.com right now. Kevin, thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.